Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Hello and welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. First segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Lakeshore Counselor Tracy Bailey. So tell me a little bit about the accessibility features of the new park.
So there's some wonderful accessibility features. We have what we've put down as an access mat, so it's a portable and removable rollout access. And with that, we put a sign that helps to enable awareness for beach users and hopefully protects, once you have awareness, we're protecting against vandalism and that sort of thing. So we have that wonderful addition that allows access to the water, and we also have accessibility benches happening in there as well.
So, what was the inspiration behind this? Why did you feel it was an important project to support?
Well, I think it's extremely important. We know that people today, disabilities impact the lives of many Ontarians. We know that 1 in 7 people have a disability today. We know that there's certainly an urgency and a due diligence to achieve, the mandates around creating inclusive spaces by 2020. And really, I think it's that whether you have a disability or not, everyone should have equal access.
So, were there any challenges in putting the accessibility features in?
There's certainly challenges. We know that the cost, I guess, is a substantial financial contribution is needed when you try to make public spaces accessible. Certainly looking at the plans around financial capabilities, you begin to wonder whether or not it's feasible that you can achieve some of your goals by 2020. So that certainly is a barrier, the financial impacts. Some of the other barriers, I guess, just come up with public education. So once the public is informed and understands its uses, then, they protect the space and understand the need to ensure that it's not vandalized and that we take care of our equipment and, things like the swings and accessible swings and things like that we have. The more and more that education's out there and people are aware of the use and the reasons why we have them, then we reserve them for people that need that in terms of access and inclusion.
So how did you go about spreading the word about this available space, this accessibility upgrade?
What's fantastic is certainly social media helped us to spread that. Lakeshore in particular was just absolutely thrilled to be first to go ahead with things like the access mat and, set a precedent for other municipalities and other areas to come and learn about it and see what it is and, spread the word for us as well. We know that we're attracting people not just from Lakeshore but from all areas that want to come out and take advantage of being able to be in an inclusive space. So anyone can use it. So what's nice about getting the word out is that it's, of course, available to everyone. In particular, it helps people with wheelchairs or strollers, anybody who has walking or mobility aids and needs some help passing over the soft sand to get to some harder sand or to the water's edge. So I think families in the community were so ready to see these kind of changes in place that spreading the word's been quite easy.
So, do you foresee more of these projects, more inclusive spaces on the horizon?
Absolutely. I would definitely think that on the horizon would be creation of more inclusive spaces throughout the entire municipality. And I think throughout all of Ontario, we're seeing that some of the legislation is moving things forward, but also people understanding that it's the right thing to do, that whether you have a disability or not, everyone deserves to have equal access, to have inclusiveness. So I certainly think that, you know, it's well within my thinking and the thinking of many others to continue to make sure that our public spaces are fully accessible for everyone to enjoy.
How has the public responded since the project began?
The public response has been fantastic. Certainly on any given weekend, we know that our space is very, very well used. But what we've really heard is we began receiving stories, and certainly myself, I received many comments from individuals who are saying, this is the first time that I've ever been this close to the water, or this is the first time that, you know, I was able to have my husband, who has some mobility needs, with us, and he watched the kids out there, you know, kiteboarding or swimming and those sort of things. So it's just been a really fantastic and positive project, certainly the right thing to do. Not really expensive when you talk about the cost of the mat in particular, $38,000 to create an inclusive space for all is pretty reasonable. So it's been very good.
So you mentioned you've received a lot of stories. Is there one that stands out for you in particular?
Yeah, several of the stories really, really impacted me and it hit me and made me think and challenged me to think differently. The one that stands out probably the most was a husband who carried his wife down to the water's edge. She has cancer. She's in final stages, very, very weak, and he carried her down to the edge and spread out a blanket, and they just sat for hours and watched, you know, the sunset. But after the space became inclusive, it was so touching to see that, you know, he could have access. He was able to push a wheelchair down that access pathway and spread a blanket and, you know, simply transfer. So I think it was just so important. The second story was of an individual who was sitting previously up at the pavilion, and she was watching her grandchildren play in the water. She, of course, was very, very far away, and every now and then the children would turn around and say, "Look at me, Grandma, I'm, you know, playing in the water," or something like that. And she felt extremely disconnected, and after a while the kids continued playing and kind of forgot she was there. But, you know, the flip side of that is now being able to be right at the water's edge and be part of the activity that's actually going on with your family and your loved ones. So certainly a passionate subject for me. It hasn't hit me personally, so very fortunate that way, but very, very passionate from a community standpoint and from it being the right thing to do and understanding that access should be for everyone. 1 in 7 people have a need to have better inclusive environments, and we certainly should be building them everywhere we are. So I'm proud that we are making these great strides for sure.
So if you could send any message to the community and to our leaders about the need for more projects such as this, what would you say?
I think my biggest message is absolutely that 1.85 million people in Ontario have a disability, and that's 1 in 7. So whether you have a disability or not, everyone deserves equal access and inclusiveness.
So what are the next steps going forward?
Well, I certainly think the next steps going forward is remembering the inclusiveness in everything we do. So certainly taking great strides to ensure that every new public space is automatically accessible. Every changing space includes accessible features. Looking at things just very simplistically, at our marina we have handles that were round, typical door handles, and we learned really quickly that the decision really should have been rectangular handles that you simply push down. We learned very quick that there were people who couldn't use the doorknob, but it's just a matter of actually thinking it through and understanding that there are options available that provide very natural spaces with accessibility, and that it seems to be when we build things in natural spaces that we're just not thinking about the accessible nature that needs to be present.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
My sincere hope is, as Tracy mentioned, these spaces are respected. To some kid out there, it's an art project. It's putting up graffiti that no one's going to understand anyway, but to a person with a disability, having this space respected sends a very clear message. Sends the message, you have a right to be here. You have a right to use these facilities just as much as anyone. The only issue I foresee is the great disconnect. How one person defines accessibility may not necessarily be another person's definition. Fact is, you cannot, by any means, cover every potential base, every potential situation. However, it is refreshing to see that Lakeshore is taking into consideration, as much as possible, to give people an opportunity just to enjoy these spaces. It's an incredible thing. For that gentleman whose wife had cancer, that must have been such a beautiful moment, just to recognize that they'd be able to share it. They'd be able to take in the nature and the experience that was available. Disability need not limit anything, in my judgment. It may require an adaptation, but that's everything. People have this need to push forward, to change, and to grow. Life isn't stagnant, and disability is simply a matter of thinking in a new way. Thinking, what can we do to make things easier and more effective? And get right down to it, it's not a matter of obligation. It's a matter of privilege to stand by our brothers, sisters, friends, teachers, to stand by the community, which is comprised very largely of people with disabilities. The statistic Tracy gave, it's alarming, but the number may in fact be a lot larger. For their undiagnosed disabilities, there are things that the medical community is still somewhat hesitant on, that they're still learning about. So, fact is, we can't say it's all right for you to enter this space because you walk a certain way, you think a certain way, you speak a certain way. And then to say, nah, we're not going to include you because you move a little differently or think or speak a little differently. That's creating the impossible standard, my friends. It's creating a wall that nobody gets through. If you go around looking for reasons to single people out or to deny access, you'll find them, but you'll also find that nobody anywhere measures up completely. You'll find that you've created barriers that you yourself can't get through. And we, as a people, frankly deserve better. HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Delta Zetas are some of the most devoted students at the University of Windsor. Our sorority is built upon four pillars: academics, sisterhood, philanthropy, and leadership. We are known as successful women on campus and leaders within our community. Right now, we are looking for amazing women to join our sisterhood. For more information, check out Delta Zeta on Facebook.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Lakeshore counselor Tracy Bailey. Our show, we'll hear from John Morris and Tom Cox, who will be telling us about Wagger Syndrome. So tell me a little bit about your experiences with Wagger Syndrome.
Our experiences. Well, John, why don't you take that one first?
So my experience is having never heard of it prior to my oldest daughter being born, who she is shortly turning four. But yes, she was born 4 years ago, kind of a very ordinary, childbirth. We didn't really know anything beforehand. It But when she was born, we noticed the first couple of weeks her eyes did not open. And, you know, to keep it short, after several months of noticing that, along with some other delays, when we went to the hospital, it was determined that she did not have irises in her eyes, known as aniridia. And follow-up genetic testing did reveal that she had a deletion on one of her 11th chromosomes, which is how Wagner syndrome is diagnosed. You know, as far as a little bit of our history, you know, Miranda has a lot of challenges. She is legally blind. She's had surgery for her cataracts that she had in her eyes. Although she hasn't had a Wilms tumor yet, we still have to get ultrasounds every 3 months to assess. She's developmentally delayed. She's about a two-year-old as far as on the developmental scale. She does get multiple types of therapies almost daily at school right now.
So can you tell me a little bit about some of the supports that have proven the most effective since the diagnosis?
Go ahead, Tom.
Well, let me just give the quick story from my end. My daughter, Jenna, is 19 years old now, and she is a survivor of childhood cancer, the Wilms tumor that John mentioned that she had at about age two, which involved 6 weeks of chemo, surgery to remove her right kidney, and then another dozen weeks of two chemo drugs. Then the next dozen or so years of her life were mostly developmental more than purely medical. And now about the last couple of years, well, we've been dealing with this for 4 or 5 years, but she's had 7 eye surgeries in the last 2.5 years, all done at Cincinnati Eye Institute, where she's received limbal corneal stem cell transplants, 2 artificial iris implants, cornea transplant, and some other stuff too. So as far as what's helped the most, you know, she was diagnosed at 4 days old. We were immediately sent across town to a pediatric ophthalmologist who said that our child had a 60 to 70% chance of developing cancer in her first 2 to 3 years of life, which she did. And then we got involved, you know, our world was rocked, but we got involved as an early intervention. And then when she became school age in the States here, we have an IEP, an individualized education plan for a child, which puts together basically a team of therapists and educators to help her move through school. She graduated high school. She's taken classes at local community college.
So do you find the medical community is well informed about the syndrome?
Did you get that, John?
Yes, I did.
When you speak to it, I didn't quite hear all of it.
Oh, okay. So, no, in my short experience, and I actually work for a hospital as well, you know, I can tell you as a healthcare practitioner, I had never heard of Wagner syndrome. Maybe only one person I spoke to. I live right near Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and the geneticist there had actually met and diagnosed 2 other kids with Wagner syndrome. You know, when you think of Wagner, you're thinking, you know, the anachronism really speaks to a little bit of the breadth of what you see there. There's no Wagner specialist, but, you know, the W is for Wilms tumors, right? So you're going to, you know, visit with endocrinologists, kidney specialists, oncologists, predisposition oncologists. With your aniridia, you're going to have your specialist in ophthalmology. With some of the genitourinary issues, obviously there's kind of a large plethora of specialists you'll see for that. And then obviously speaking to the developmental delays, that's where your large spectrum of therapies, your developmental pediatricians are going to be experts in that area. But, you know, to speak to that, there's no one who really encompasses or who is a specialist overseeing all of that. You know, you have a developmental pediatrician who keeps track of your child's progress as far as developmentally and is able to guide you and navigate you through the medical world to get you the services you need. But case in point at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, which I think is one of, you know, it's a great hospital. We've had great experiences, but none of the developmental pediatricians there have ever met a kid with Wagner syndrome.
So in terms of the association, have there been any success moments in terms of raising awareness or just improving the quality of life for those affected?
Well, let me give a little brief history, very, very brief. Wagger syndrome, John just gave you the acrostic, W-A-G-R. It's not just a rare disease. It's beyond, far beyond ultra rare. It's what's called an orphan disease, affecting only about 425 people worldwide. That's 27 different countries. And it's called an orphan disease because it's so rare that, you know, hardly anybody's going to look at it. With that said, a group of moms basically found each other on the internet in about, roughly 1998 or 9. And then a website was started, and then a little questionnaire was put together to see the commonalities of our kids. And then there was, if there was one doctor that knows most about it, it would be Dr. Joan Hahn, H-A-N, who's now in Memphis, Tennessee, but she was at the National Institutes of Health, and she did a study that was pretty comprehensive and published in the New England Medicine. Beyond that, we have an annual get-together for our families that John and I just saw each other at, came off of, which is a great time to connect these kids and their families. And then our wagger.org, W-A-G-R.org website is the best repository of information that there is on this syndrome.
So if you could send any one message to the community about the syndrome and the work that needs to continue, what would you say?
John, why don't you take the lead on that?
I think as far as the medical community is concerned, I think just making them abundantly aware of it. I think as a rare disease or as an orphan disease, as Tom alluded to, being such a small number, one, it's our responsibility. One of our challenges is to continue to increase that number. We have a patient registry that is very exciting where all the data related to our kids can be inputted into. And so one of the things I would talk to the community is to you know, really get involved. If your child has Wagger, there's not many of us, so, you know, get the registry completed. It's important for rare diseases like Wagger because this pool of data otherwise would be impossible to collect, and it increases the knowledge about the symptoms as well as the features. And, you know, talking to the medical community, the physicians would be able to use this data collected to learn more about this disorder. And then subsequently researchers, because there's some type of controlled access, right, they'd be able to study the characteristics and maybe, you know, connect the researchers could then maybe be connected with the patients and possibly drive some research to investigate both about Wagger syndrome, how we can improve, you know, the lives of each individual who has been diagnosed with this condition.
Like to thank you both for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Absolutely.
Orphan disease, or if it affects one, that's too many. The fact of the matter is, any condition out there, if it affects one person, chances are it affects others. The fact is, these people need to come together to forge understanding, community, strength, just to learn from each other's ideas and come to the realization you don't have to face it alone. But hearing the story of an iris transplant, that is amazing to me. It really was just an incredible thing. The fact that this condition can have such a negative impact, it's appalling that there isn't greater awareness, that more people aren't taking the time to say, these conditions are out there. One day I might run into someone who's affected. Why don't I learn all that I can? I admit, these days, people want answers good, fast, and cheap, but the mark of a truly compassionate and well-grounded person, it's the ability to step outside oneself and to ask questions. This doesn't affect me directly, but it may someday. It may affect someone I know or care about. So why don't I broaden my own knowledge? Not for the sake of necessarily being a medical professional who can respond to this, but to enrich myself as a person. Understanding disability is understanding the community, about different types of people, the fact that we all have something unique and wonderful to offer. And yes, many young people these days figure if you can't look it up on a phone, odds are it's not to be found. But if everyone took such an attitude, we'd never accomplish anything. We'd never come together for those very few affected by this condition. They would have to simply find their own solutions, find their own answers. And that's not fair. No family facing any type of condition should ever have to shoulder everything themselves. They shouldn't have to spend time they could be using with their loved one to go and demand of the medical community the answers that they should simply be entitled to. Fact is, disability life really is just about community. It is about bringing people together, broadening ourselves and our communities. It is about creating the next opportunity, never to rest on our laurels. Earlier in our show, with the interview with Tracy Bailey, she talked about how Lakeshore could be a model for other communities. The question is, will these other communities be responsive? Or will they say to themselves, we have this, it's good enough? The fact is, unless there's true equality for all people, regardless of where they're coming from, how they move, how they think, how they feel, unless there's true equality, there's no equality. Acceptance is not the afterthought of life, folks. Acceptance should simply be taken into consideration. For the medical side of things, these doctors should be taught about rare conditions. Shouldn't just be, yeah, you know how to hold a scalpel, we'll graduate you. No. Doctors have a responsibility to their fellow human being, not just to collect a paycheck, but to be a source of support, to be advocates for these children affected with things like Wagner syndrome, and to be willing to give the very best quality and care that they can. And if our leaders and our professionals aren't doing this, the question then becomes, why are they leaders? Why are they acknowledged as professionals? If they are not taking the time, even for themselves, to understand what accessibility truly is, or things like an orphan disease, if they're not doing this, then they're not giving their best. Admittedly, medical science and the professionals therein can only cover so many things, so many areas of knowledge. But if a doctor doesn't have the answer, it's no shame for anyone to ask a question or to consult someone. We all have to do it. It's a sign of maturity and of growth to the one who seeks to increase their own wisdom. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal, so get on out there and have yourselves a good one. You've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.